Hello, assalamu alaikum, everybody. Welcome to episode 5, where we have a guest, one of our favorite Safdar Alam, coming in talking about his experience and his thoughts on how the Islamic finance system is a scam. But we'll get into the nuances of that, and love to bring MB, Abdullah, and T back in to discuss
Hello.
First their thoughts. Actually, just before we move a bit forward, I wanted to ask, like, T, you spent some time in finance. Like, what was it that changed for you? Like, what made you kind of go like, okay, no, Bitcoin is the only way. The base is just not wrong.
So I was in wealth management specifically for the majority of my career. And when we would talk to clients and we would choose investments for them and put them in portfolios, and I saw how a lot of advisors acted with clients and how they chose their investments. There was no real thought of, you know, trying to think of the bigger picture, or you know how there was a time when investments were made based on, hey, I think this business is going to do well in the future for XYZ reason. Like, the core of why people invest didn't exist. It was other reasons. So it was, I need to make my sales for this month. If I do this product, I get a better percentage. So I'm going to try to push the client to this product. It wasn't explicit, but we all knew it. They talked about it behind the scenes. And I started recognizing and feeling like, wait a minute, like everything we've been taught, like this whole thing feels like a scam. I mean, listen, if you met me in 2011, I would have been those guys who would have said, asset allocation, dude, like, you know what I mean? I would have been one of those guys, right? And then so, you know, things then over time, I just started realizing it. And then one of my buddies owned Bitcoin since 2013. And the only reason he got into it was because he was on Reddit and he didn't even understand it. He doesn't understand it to this day. Imagine this. This guy has owned Bitcoin since 2013 and he says it's a scam. He still thinks it's a scam, but he's like, I'm just going to hold it anyway.
Like, even with your friend that doesn't fully understand it, does he at least understand that he is getting the opportunity to self-bank?
No, he thinks it's all a scam. That's what I'm telling you. He thinks that's never going to happen because it's psychologically, it's very hard for people to understand that everything you've known for the last 100 years, a lot of it was built on lies. This kind of goes outside of our scope, but everything from media, economics, as we can tell, money, you know, a lot of it was built on lies, right?
100%. And, you know, that's a big inspiration for my current work as well. Like, how does business look like on Bitcoin? What's the missing pieces? What do we need to do? And we did get into that, like, start getting into that conversation at least.
So if we're going to think about this question, we can't think about this question without thinking about it from the ground up. It's difficult to then just come out and say, this is how it's going to go until we kind of understand what the role of Bitcoin will be in the economy, in the world, right? First, we have to establish that. Then we have to establish, okay, what do we expect if this is how Bitcoin is established and this is what it's doing? What do we expect to be built on top of it? What problems is it solving? Is it solving the problem of, for example, social media, right? Nostr is the example here, right? So it's solving the problem of centralized social media. Digital identity is another one. I think it's a very, very important one because with the increase in bots online, right? And everybody saying they're going to, like, I think Facebook, Instagram have said they're employing bots on a large scale now. Right. So we're going to see more and more bots. I mean, I see them every day in my DMs in Twitter trying to get me to donate money. Anyway, the bot problem is a real issue. Right. We're going to have to, in a digital world, figure out who's a real person and who's not. And that's going to become more complex as the AI becomes more complex. So there are a lot of moving parts here. And I think it's important to focus on, like, the basic things and trying to build up from the simpler stuff first and then adding complexity when we think about this.
I think one of the problems I have with, like, many people that are in Bitcoin, and this was especially true in the early days, like stuff that kind of culminated into the block size war, is that, like, people immediately thought, like, all right, this has to scale right now to billions of people that need to do, like, direct peer-to-peer payment right now. Like, it has to happen right now. So, like, we need to increase the block size. We need to allow all of these transactions to happen. But, like, I think the more correct and the more rational approach is to, like, all right, is the demand there for it right now? If it's not, that doesn't mean don't build it. It just means that, like, if you can anticipate that demand increasing in the future, it's good because it gives you that time to build that out. So, like, you have something that's more fleshed out. That's the low time preference approach. And to be honest, I think getting onto a Bitcoin standard, like, it will force us, whether we like it or not, it will force us to be low time preference. You don't get to choose to be low time preference, because if you're starting to act in a high time preference way on Bitcoin, guess what? You're going to get wrecked. Like, that's how it should be. It's like you have the freedom to act in a high time preference way when it comes to finance, when it comes to accumulating capital, when it comes to doing commerce, but you will get wrecked. And that's the thing that I like about Bitcoin, is that it will finally force us to act like adults and not like incompetent children. And I think that's like the low time preference approach that will apply to basically all aspects of society, I hope, inshallah.
So I personally am two minds about that, because I think there is actual use of Bitcoin happening today to like bootstrap certain like projects or ventures, or even like pay people. Like in some ways, if we are trying to reward people for doing some work with us or whatever, we will pay them in Bitcoin right now. And also, like as we were talking about the crypto bros that are ex-bankers coming into crypto, and then particularly with the ordinals, which is, I also kind of came back into Bitcoin through the ordinals ecosystem. There is very much that experience of like, oh, we got to do this today, we got to do this now, we got to scale it to a billion right away. And I do split from them on that. I'm like, no, like you got to just build the sound fundamentals. You got to stop thinking in a fiat way, start thinking in a sound money way. And that will take time, which, is not satisfactory to that speculative spirit. And I would say, in that discussion of speculative spirit, I'm hoping to avoid a crisis now, as naive as that might sound. But I do believe there's a case for, if you can get speculative spirit, okay, how about this? Let's say the Islamic finance world has a spiritual crisis right now. Can you, like, I think we can clearly see that, not necessarily everybody can, but let's just say tomorrow everybody in Islamic finance has that spiritual crisis. What do they do? I just feel like they could come and see Pod Systems, be like, oh, Pod Systems and this podcast, like, how are you guys doing things? How are you guys financing things? How are you guys building tools? How are you guys growing things? Now, we haven't fully developed all of that out, but maybe let's just spend a bit of time imagining what that could look like.
All right, so welcome to another episode of the River Resistance Podcast. Today we have a very great episode where we will be talking about Islamic finance and Islamic banking. We also have a guest on our show. We have Saftar Alam. Saftar, could you go ahead and introduce yourself real quick?
It's a pleasure to be here, of course. My background is in Islamic finance. Before that, it was banking and finance. I am a qualified chartered accountant. I moved into investment banking. After about 10 years of that, I moved into Islamic banking, which was just checking off at that time. And so since that time, I've been specializing in Islamic finance and Islamic banking. I did spend quite a few of my early years, about 10 or 15, was Islamic banking specifically. And interestingly, I did work for conventional banks, not Islamic banks. So I worked for UBS and JP Morgan, where I was the global head of Islamic banking. And my client was a whole Islamic banking market. The banks I were with, we were wholesale. So our clients were the institutions who were delivering products into the market. So I had to understand how 20 or 30 different Islamic banks across different countries, how they all worked and how things worked with Sharia and governance and approval. So the learning curve I had was quite steep and I learned a lot. So since then, I'm a lot more involved with the fintech side of it. I've also been active on the education side. So I've taught some postgraduate courses on Islamic finance at universities in London. And I have some books that are published on Islamic finance and Islamic banking. So the last 25 years, 100% of my professional and a lot of my personal life has been purely focused on Islamic banking and Islamic finance.
Wow. You clearly have been in this space for quite some time, and I've been meaning to ask you for a while. The question is, what do you see as the biggest problem in the Islamic banking sector in general?
The biggest problem I see is Muslims. It might be a bit facile, but in terms of the overlap between finance and our deen, at every single level, we are now at a worse position than we would have been if there was no Islamic finance. So Islamic finance has not just been a failure, it's been an active source of incredible damage to Muslims. If we had done nothing and if we had lived in riba for the last 50 years, we would not be in a worse position today than we are. When I talk to people about implementing a mode of finance or economics in a way that is demanded of us, the biggest obstacles to that are Muslims. It's very difficult to explain to Muslims how damaging we are to ourselves because we feel we've got Islamic finance, it's there, so it must be helpful. It's very difficult intellectually and emotionally for Muslims to get over that hurdle.
Yeah, it does feel like the Islamic finance industry is kind of masking the problems. And as long as we can get some scholars to sign off on it and it has that halal stamp, who are regular Muslims like us to even question that? So there's a lot of complacency around it. And you know, we've had Islamic finance and Islamic banking for over 50 years now. And I don't see anything that's extremely innovative or disruptive. What I'm hearing is that overall, Islamic finance and Islamic banking have just been a failure for the last 50 something years, right?
It's worse than a failure because it's brought us lower than we would have been without doing it in the first place. The first flaws that I saw in the sector were more technical and they were contractual. And it took me many, many years to understand that what is actually more important is the infrastructure that needs to exist for that to happen. And it's a very strange thing because in every other area of life outside of finance, I depend on knowledge to be given to me and I rely on scholars in every aspect of my deen and personal life. But in finance, when this same route is followed, it forces you to disconnect your brain. It stops critical thinking because all that someone has to say is this is halal. It's Sharia compliant. And so technically, what does Sharia compliant mean? It's not a straightforward thing. When we had contracts in the early stages of 20, 25 years ago, the contract would say that both parties accept this contract is aligned with the glorious Sharia. These are international banking finance contracts with billions of dollars, right? And so after a couple of years, the lawyer said, guys, actually, this doesn't mean anything. What does it mean to be aligned with Sharia? So then as views develop, a year later, one party could say this contract is not Sharia compliant anymore. So Sharia compliance has a technical meaning in the finance space, which means that there is at least one scholar who has deemed that contract to be Sharia compliant. That's all Sharia compliant means, right? And so when we talk about what's halal, we generally talk about something that's good and something that's ethical and something that's widely accepted. So I found that my natural disposition to trust everything to do with scholars and Sharia, it failed when it came to Islamic finance. And so we have to break that connection when it comes to finance. If you look at what's happening in the world, that the funds that are Sharia compliant stocks, for example, still no global Sharia basis considers ethics as part of that screening. It's based on the debt and based on percentages of income that's permissible or not permissible. And so people are beginning to understand that Sharia compliant stocks is different to being ethical.
I was working for a, let's just say, a big firm in the past. They had a Sharia compliant mutual fund. They actually were like, okay, we have to not invest in alcohol, gambling, so and so. But that's the extent of it. And I don't even think every company was doing that. But they were marketing it as Sharia compliant.
Yeah, and it's Sharia compliant because somebody somewhere has decided that these are the screens we're going to follow. And at least one scholar has deemed that to be Sharia compliant. Right. And so they are global standards now. The stock screening standards are global. There are a few different versions of them, but the overlap is 99%. The people who are now looking at the aspect of being ethical or not are people like you and me. We're the ones who are raising this question, what can be done? And the industry as a whole is saying, we're not geared up for that. We are being told clearly that Sharia compliant is not the same as ethical. And so this creates a bifurcation of Sharia in our minds that we don't come across in any other aspect of our life, right? Because for us, aligning with what scholars are telling us, aligning with the Quran and Sharia is the same as being good and ethical. But in finance, it's not.
Worried about teaching your family about money in today's world? What if there was a way to explore debt-free, riba-free, sound money principles with your kids? Introducing Bitcoin is Halal. Discover how Bitcoin as digital gold aligns with core Islamic values. No riba, sound money through scarcity, full transparency, and true property rights. Educate your family on crucial financial concepts through a fun, faith-filled adventure. Bitcoin is Halal. Adam and Layla discover digital gold. Available now from Ashiq Usman Books.
One question that I have lingering, and that I think you get this a lot, is if Islamic finance isn't so much as just a failure, but it's also been actively harming the Ummah, what would you suggest would be steps that we could collectively take to kind of get rid of this problem?
The first thing to understand is that the solution is not going to be operating in a vacuum. The problem is the problem. So there, in many Muslim countries, there's Islamic banks everywhere. So globally, there's at least 100 banks, tens of thousands of employees, 4 to 5 trillion of capital in there. And also, is we've institutionalized mobilization of scholars, that there are many institutions that develop Sharia standards. So everything that I mentioned acts as opposition to a solution because it acts as a magnet and it absorbs our capacity. So if you take a young Muslim in his 20s, they want to gain experience in Islamic finance. The only way to do it, unless you set up your own fintech, is to go to work in the Islamic finance industry. right? And the same for scholars. If you have any knowledge of finance and you want a job where you're actually going to get paid, the way to do it is go to an established Islamic finance entity. And so all the resources that we could otherwise apply to a solution, they're already removed by the industry. But also there are some institutions and there are a number of well-intentioned Muslims who are smart and are trying to implement something that's a step in the right direction. But these are incredibly small drops in the ocean. So it's beyond crazy that a solution has to be considered or developed by absolute outliers.
I'm just going to add on to that. I mean, it definitely seems like it's hard to even think of a solution where we're operating outside of that $5 trillion industry. It's a very bleak situation. That's all I'll say. I'll pass it to T.
The problem, I think, cannot be fixed until you fix the money problem that is beneath everything.
So, for example, when it comes to Bitcoin, I am a fan of Bitcoin, right? But I'm not a Bitcoin maxi. And I would say the reason I'm not a Bitcoin maxi is because I don't have enough knowledge of it. But I have a level of knowledge where the technical parts of Bitcoin overlap economic and financial fundamentals. And everything I know about it, I like a hell of a lot. So it shows that you don't need to be a Muslim to want to fight riba, right? The riba is a universal evil. And there are many movements globally that find interest in riba incredibly unethical. And so now I'm a fan of Bitcoin as sound money, as limited supply. But also when I talk about the issues of fiat, so fiat and how Islamic banking is just a module of the same system. The people who get that the quickest are the Bitcoiners. It's much harder for a regular Muslim to understand that. And so one of the things I do get from Bitcoiners is that when I point out an issue either with fiat or with Islamic banking is that Bitcoin solves this. But my view is that I don't think Bitcoin can solve a faulty mindset. This is something that Muslims had before Bitcoin and they're going to have it after Bitcoin. Even if Bitcoin did not exist, there are still things that Muslims could do that would still be in the fiat system, but you still operate in a proper Islamic way. But it means you operate with one hand tied behind your back.
Let's just take Bitcoin out of it. Say we're operating within fiat. If you were the king of Saudi, or let's just say a Muslim nation, right? What would be your first step?
I would say in an age where capital and wealth is the main driver of the world, we have been in a highly privileged position in the last couple of decades, if you take Muslims as an ummah. Yep. So I don't think we have excuses at that level. In terms of, you mentioned a gold standard. So I think a gold standard is incredibly difficult to implement. So it reminds me of after Britain had initially abandoned the gold standard after World War I, they tried to go back to it temporarily in the 1920s. And that failed. I think, you know, there were some aspects of it were just bad economics. I think the British government chose a pegged value to the gold that was inflated, that it automatically put a high value on the pound. So when they tried to, in exports, for example, and get paid in pounds, they were asking the recipients, the importers, to pay a value that was like 25% higher than the value of the currency. So that attempt to reestablish the gold standard failed because foreign trade did not work, because the other countries were off the gold standard. So when you look to work with other people, if they're not on a similar gold standard, then you're going to have issues. Also, one of the reasons why return to a gold standard appears to be beyond any possibility is linked to what I mentioned earlier, that any intellectual capital we have in this area is directed towards Islamic finance. One of the things that really opened my mind was I went to speak with the trade finance guys. I worked with them to help develop Islamic trade finance solutions. And inevitably, most of them were around debt and credit. But there's actually something tangible that I could see being delivered from one place to the other. And so this was in contrast to most of the capital that I saw flowing, because I worked at the top tier investment banks. And when you work on economies of scale, you do deals only above a certain level. Like a $100 million deal would barely be worth considering, because the work involved in creating a deal for $100 million is the same amount of work as creating a deal for $10 billion. The fixed costs are the same.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just numbers. That $500 million was called benchmark at the time. You sign the contract and the money's gone, and then it comes back in the future with interest on top. So what I saw with trade finance was I saw some connection with something real. Trade finance effectively covers the financial risk faced by exporters. So when you're selling assets, normally tangible real assets, something that's manufactured or created within a particular country and is exported to another country, you have significant risk in that process, right? First of all, it's going to a port, it's going onto a ship, and it's going to be at sea for weeks or months, and it's going to arrive, and then it has to be delivered to the person who bought it. And at that time, the person's going to check everything, and then he will pay or he won't pay, right? So all of these steps really result in largely unmanageable risk for the exporter. What financial institutions have come in to say is that, look, when you've agreed a sale with somebody in another country, a bank in that country, so in the same country as the importer, they will say, we will financially guarantee his performance. If he defaults, the bank will pay. It removes a lot of financial uncertainty in international exports. So you might find that if you have an exporter in Britain or America exporting to Africa, for example, even if an African bank gives a guarantee of the performance of the importer, the credit risk of the transaction moves from your customer, the importer, to the bank. And in many cases, that bank itself might not have the credit risk that you need. So then the government sometimes steps in. And then you get government-linked agencies who, in many countries, they are AAA, and they will finance imports and exports. So when I looked at trade finance, I worked with some entities who do actually try to do good things. So one of them was the Islamic Development Bank. When I say try to do good things, I don't mean individuals. So Islamic Development Bank was an institution that was, I think, trying to do some things the right way. One of their subdivisions, ITFC, International Trade Finance Corporation, deals with trade finance. So they were looking to get involved in financing exports and import. And rather than just give a credit, what they were trying to do was actually support the risk by buying the good that's being exported. The exporter, he sells the good to this institution pays him immediately. Then this institution takes the risk of delivering the goods elsewhere. And they make a profit on that. And so we were talking about, once the goods are loaded onto the ship, about marine insurance for the trip. And it was really fascinating stuff. And so even when I was talking about trade finance, even in JP Morgan, it was still large numbers, you know, $100 million. So the things that I find most interesting, and I think provide the absolute best arena for Islamic finance, is real business. And it doesn't need to be big. You can walk to your nearest, even smaller than a high street, you need to get cornered. These are all run by a family or a person, but he's doing something real and tangible. We have tons of trucks on them and lorries, and they're all doing something and going somewhere. There's a whole arena of real industry and sector outside of the financial world that is demanding capital. And interestingly, when we look at SMEs, small and medium enterprises in the UK, we have hundreds of thousands of them. Because of their smaller size, they tend to struggle to obtain bank finance. And so that is a very interesting gap where I think capital from Muslims can be looked to plug it into industries. One of the issues I have with funds, now, you know, if you have some money to invest on a retail level, you're going to put most of it into some kind of stock equity fund, right? Mutual fund. Even there, we are disseminating our wealth outwards into nothingness. It doesn't even go to the legal entity that's issued the equity because it's not primary issuance. It's just absorbed into a secondary market. So one of the issues I have is that when we have capital in the Muslim Ummah, the first thing we tend to do is we disperse it outside of ourselves. That's a real waste. I read that the Mormon dollar had circulated 13 times amongst the Mormon community before it left them. And I think that's something we don't have. But I think Islamic finance could absolutely begin on a community scale. If I gather the Muslims in my area, we could find a real business near where we live. If it's Muslim, it's good, but it doesn't need to be a Muslim. We will find somebody who's just honest, hardworking, has a business that earns cash and could benefit from injection of capital and deliver returns to people. And that would be perfect. Because one thing that our religion tells us, it actually tells us how capital should be circulated in an economy. And debt has become a commercial product, right? When debt is not allowable to you, then the only way you have of earning profit is actually to find a business that's going to deliver equity. Profit for you. So it's an absolute blueprint of how to allocate and distribute capital in the economy.
I have a question. Having attempted to build a business, the biggest problem that I hear is about liquidity. From what you're saying about keeping it small and having a community-based approach to finance, it seems like liquidity would be incredibly hard and difficult. Is that intentional? Do you think that's the true spirit?
For any sector to reach a scale that is meaningful, liquidity has to exist. The initial project or institution that attracts capital can be small. What will provide liquidity is when this small level transaction is repeated thousands of times. Then there's way to introduce liquidity at that stage. You do need a certain amount to exceed inertia. But of course, I mentioned earlier about economies of scale, the same difficulties apply when you have small deals, right? And also the intellectual due diligence that needs to be done for a transaction is not that much different if you inject £10,000 into a local shop or $10 million into an industry. So that's something that does need to be considered and fixed. And that will be an issue in terms of reaching a reasonable amount of scale. And I think the failure to introduce liquidity will effectively kill these instruments.
And just to add to that, you know, one thing which Bitcoin would allow, micro lending. You could have somebody who's sending goods from Dubai to Atlanta, whatever, and that 100,000 in Bitcoin terms, you could basically fund each deal on its own, and then just micro transactions, a crowd of people would get a return and would be, you know, this many days, X whatever, upon payment, and you can kind of spread the risk out amongst a lot of participants. You could create infrastructure like this to basically build the future of Islamic finance on top of Bitcoin.
I do want to say, though, why I've adopted this idea or the hijra towards sound money is that, look, at a small scale, building any business up to from that 10,000 to that 10 million that you really need to get to inertia, nothing works better than lending. And, you know, the fiat world knows that, and that's why they use only lending in that scale. And if you want to do it in a halal way, you need to also enable Qard Hasana. But you have no way to do Qard Hasana on a fiat system, and you have to switch over to a sound money system to do that.
Just to add on that, we had easy money lending for, 12 years, 13 years through the Fed. And when you do that, obviously costs rise across the board versus a sound money standard. Everything would cost a lot less. Overall lending would be less. You could save faster. Our business could have enough money in lesser time. Keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, cost of capital, right?
One of the questions that's still kind of lingering is that, say, if you have a student that's just freshly graduated from college and they are interested in finance, what advice would you give to that freshly graduated student?
I was fortunate enough to work in blue chip institutions, so that provided a very high quality training ground for me. I actually worked on the trading floor and I was working with exotic derivatives. And you know, before I was that knowledgeable, or to be honest, before I cared that much about my DNA in terms of financial space, I was in a place where I learned a lot in a quality manner at high quality institutions. And so the reason I mentioned that is because I follow a lot of Islamic forums online, and there people ask, I've got a job offer, but they do something, they do some lending, they do this, you know, what can I do? In general, the best answers I see, like, speak to a scholar that you trust. So I would not recommend anybody to go and do something haram. But I have to be honest and say, I see the benefit of me having done that for a long time. I see a very big difference in quality, just of knowledge and understanding of people who haven't gone through a very rigorous training regime. Even today, in the startup space, there are a number of fintechs that I know personally, where the people who are involved with them don't have a strong finance background. And some are exceptional people. But the ones who are not exceptional, they pose a risk to Muslims. And also don't understand the risk of failure and what that would mean for the sector. Right? So there are people who are not bright enough doing things they have no right to be doing in Islamic finance because they see it as a way to make money. But I would not advise anybody to not go into it. We will be failing is if we have intellectually capable Muslims at a young age who have in their mind that they want to support or work in some way Islamic finance and not given real opportunities to deliver their intellectual capacity to it.
Ultimately, if anything is going to change, it's going to have to be done at the individual level where you have people that are starting out, that are starting businesses, that are actually trying to implement actual Islamic finance. So I think we will go ahead and wrap it up. I just want to say thank you so much, Softar, for joining us. This has been a great, great conversation.
There are 2 billion Muslims in the world. Some of them are holding a Bitcoin summit in April in Plano, Texas. They have read each and every book about Bitcoin and Austrian economy that's out there, and they've even published a book about it. They're not focusing on Bitcoin as an investment opportunity for the already wealthy to get even more fiat rich. Instead, they are concentrating on using it as an alternative to the current fiat system. Against the interest-based economy, against the loss of value in lifetime through inflation, against gatekeepers and daily money transactions, as a real currency, just like Satoshi Nakamoto intended. They are fighting the greatest evil that has afflicted humanity, which robs everyone, not just Muslims, of time, money, and effort, and has caused endless suffering and wars. Riba. And on top of that, they are shilling Nostr as the greatest sovereign Bitcoin marketplace in theory and practice. Y'all have no idea what Bitcoin is if you're not focusing on this event with your laser eyes. Head over to MuslimBTCSummit.com and get your ticket now.
Well, what was the highlights? What was the highlights of that conversation for you? We had a long conversation. We could have gone on forever, I think. And we were getting to somewhere productive at the end. But what was the highlight for you, MB?
I really like that Softar was just like, you know, obviously, like, the main reason why I wanted to talk to him is because I love hearing him say that Islamic banking is like a scam. You know, I really found it interesting that, like, as I was, like, pushing him with the questions, he did say that the Islamic finance industry is a waste. It's, like, a negative for the Muslim Ummah because, like, it drains all of this potential capital and investment, and then it just gets sucked into Islamic finance, which is, like, not even anything that's actually halal or is like getting us closer to adhering to the commandments of Allah, all of this stuff just ends up being wasted. It's actually not just like something that is like this other thing, but something that's actually negatively impacting the ummah. I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah, that was cool. I really did like his perspective, and it was very interesting to hear his experience working in regular finance and then switching to Islamic finance. You know, I was very curious to know how he would create an alternative system. MB, as you know, for us, I mean, Bitcoin is our framework for how we see economics and, you know, trade and everything, right? So I was very curious to know that for someone who's outside of Bitcoin, but does see the issues there, even from the Muslim perspective, what they thought were possible alternatives.
You know, possible alternatives, I was not satisfied. I think we went at it for a bit, but it wasn't in any way conclusive for me. We were actually being a little nice. Like he was like, you know, be harsher than you are already being harsh about Islamic finance. Should we discuss like some of what we think should have been discussed or might have been left out from that interview?
To be honest, I actually like that Softar is just like very good for sounding the alarm about like all of the problems that are in Islamic finance. I don't think he needs to be the main one that's like proposing solutions. We need more people in Islamic finance to just like sound the alarm. Like, so this is why like I love Softar and other there are others in Islamic finance that are like sounding the alarm, that are letting everybody know there is something horribly, horribly wrong that everyone needs to be paying attention to. And this Islamic finance isn't just like, it's not just that it's not working, it's negatively impacting us. And I think like even just saying that is already really powerful.
I wanted to add, Hudhayfa, so you mentioned why it wasn't conclusive, right? It was never going to be conclusive. And the reason it was never going to be conclusive is because the base is not there. Like, until you fix the money, right? That's our whole point here, right? In this podcast or even, you know, our worldview, which is until you fix the money problem, then anything you build on top of it is eventually going to either collapse or be shaky.
When you asked him that great question of like, you know, if he was king for a day, what would he do? He went into saying how we got to bootstrap capital from like the bottom up, you know, fund small Muslim businesses, you know, hardworking people. And then build our own economy. Like, that's what I got. I'll say from my experience, that's something I've kind of tried, you know, building my startup in the car finance world, just trying to get people to go do Uber, you know, go do Uber, make some money, pay everybody back a share of what you earn, something like that, okay? And that faced a lot of the fiat problems, and it's something I say, like, I went to slay a monster and then became that same monster myself. And Safdar has seen a lot of this. Like, he's seen more than I have, honestly. Do you guys have similar thoughts?
Yeah. I don't think that Bitcoin is going to get rid of banking. Like, I think that's a very naive idea. But I do think Bitcoin will radically change. And I do think that there will be a more incentive for people to take more responsibility of their own wealth. Like, eventually we'll start to see banks themselves actually behave more responsibly. And you'll see that the need for debt is going to shift rather than from consumption, rather than like for production. So like, in order for someone to give out a loan on a fixed supply of money, you have to make the business case for where the returns on this business or the return on your capital is going to outpace the appreciation of just holding Bitcoin. To me, that's like where finally capital will be more productive in that aspect.
I think there's a real need for liquidity, like whether it's small companies or large companies, what banks really provide as a service is liquidity. And I think this was something that we were starting to touch upon in the interview with Safdar as well. It's like, okay, we can set up our own banks. We're self-banking. We're bootstrapping, funding little small ventures and small businesses. How do you create these, or how do you create better liquidity in Bitcoin? Like, are we just relying on volatility, and are we just relying on number go up to achieve that?
No. Number is going to stop going up at some point. That's the number one thing to remember. Like, okay, the reason why the number go up meme exists is because Bitcoin has gone up quickly. So that world is going to end at some point, okay? The way it'll look is probably like you overshoot the target, it'll come crashing down at the equilibrium price, but there's a price, and we can measure it in dollars, but there's going to come a point where we hit an equilibrium, and at that point our unit of account will switch to sats. That's really, like, I don't know how it's going to happen. We don't know what it'll look like, but that's essentially what the result will be. right? Here's where I kind of disagree with you guys. So this is interesting. I first of all, we have to remember that just because the fiat system is going away, that doesn't mean that interest, fiat, and Ponzi's are going to go away. They will 100% exist on Bitcoin.
Ordinals are fiat on Bitcoin. Like, I will say it. I'll be the first to say it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there will certainly be less lending. And that's just a function of, if we think that Bitcoin is going to end up being the settlement layer of the world finance, right? Let's just assume that's the final version. And that's when we reach our equilibrium price. Then what would happen is it would create a more simple, direct type of finance. Economics would become a lot more simple. Trade would become a lot more simple, less friction, less costs. This is why I always say we should expect, with AI efficiency and Bitcoin efficiency by a Bitcoin standard, prices would drastically drop across the board of everything.
I think what's more likely to happen is like more of this like fragmentation of where you're not going to have these huge banks that are acting irresponsibly, that constantly get bailed out. So they're constantly over leveraged and they're giving out more loans than they're actually supposed to. So what I think, you know, what makes sense under this kind of system is that you have a lot of smaller banks that are more localized, that are more trusted within a family or an extended family or a big community or tribe. That kind of fits very well into having localized network states, where you'll have trusted banks that do business within these trusted circle of people that constitute a tribe or a network state or whatever.
So what I hear, I'm just like trying to tie this all back and, you know, include software as well. And it seems to be an ongoing conversation. Nothing's conclusive. There are many different possible paths. And for all of those paths, I think different infrastructure needs to be built, whether it's a protocol, whether it's Nostr, whether it's digital identity. I'd love to see more of that spirit of just builders building tools right now to serve some immediate customers and in preparation for a whole slew of customers in the future. You know, it's always slowly, slowly, and then all at once, right? And I guess that is that all at once issue really does come from a sort of crisis. Now, it may not be a crisis in a traditional sense. It might really be just a spiritual crisis, although you might argue otherwise. It's a whole asset crisis. It could be like a war crisis.
Most likely, it would be all of the above. Any way you spin it, you're going to be dealing with a period of time that is going to be very uncertain. It's going to be full of a lot of chaos and difficulty and challenges, and every place is going to vary, right? That's the only way we get to Bitcoin. Once it's established, after that, then the real development will begin. And you know how you said, Hudaifa? You were like, well, I don't like that there's not enough creativity and there's not enough being built on Bitcoin. And simply the reason is because the need has not come up
yet. There's no demand for it right now.
The demand will come. Like, I think of the beginnings of the internet, right? Back then, there was no demand for internet commerce. There were people at the time saying, internet is never going to have commerce. X, Y, Z. These are the reasons why it'll never work. Blah, blah, blah. Some people said security. Some people said something else. And I was a kid back then, but I still remember hearing these conversations. It's weird how now we're having the exact same conversations again. But the difference between the internet and this is that was information fracturing. This is money fracturing, right? It's way more important than just information.
I think the crisis is like, okay, a mass of the population recognizes that there is a problem, and that is what actually needs to happen, instead of it being like a niche part of the population that recognizes it. Now, one thing that I want to just, I guess, underline the conversation with is that the fiat system has this zero-sum approach. Like, most things you do in fiat, like, winner takes all is the approach. And I believe a sound money system, even if you don't remove that entirely, you strongly encourage a lot more joint venture, a lot more shared volatility, shared risk, shared reward approaches. And I think it will, like, after the crises, it will encourage humanity to cooperate a lot better, whether it's at the community tribal scale or at a global scale. That is a world I am hopeful and excited for. And if you guys have some last thoughts, please.
Just wanted to add to that thought, Hudaifa. That's what we're all here for, right? Like, at the end of the day, we still have to be hopeful. You know, there will be a crisis, and it probably will be the most difficult thing we've, even the listeners, anybody's ever seen in their lives. But, you know, the hope and the goal is that we can eventually build something better for our children, their children, right? And that's what pushes all of us.
Going back to my point earlier, I really think that the all the craziness that we see in Islamic finance right now, I think all of that is being sustained because of the current fiat system that is underneath it. And, you know, whether, like, I don't want to get into a discussion of whether, like, the people in Islamic finance and Islamic banking are actually actively scamming others. But at
some,
the end
are.
Of the day,
some are.
Some are, perhaps. But, like, what's I think more relevant is that they are incentivized to behave in that way, because that's
100%.
The fiat system inherently pushes you toward capital misallocation and eventually capital destruction, which Islamic finance cannot escape. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. No, thank
beautifully
you.
Said.
A beautiful wrap. Appreciate it. See you all again next week. All right.
Assalamu alaikum.
Reba Resistance is a production of Pod Systems and Bitcoin Majlis.